Yes, folks, welcome to the post game.
98, man.
Getting up there.
Yeah, I'm going to hit 100 in a couple weeks.
It's gone by very quickly, right on the New Year's, it seems like.
That is the nice thing that we've kept pace because, you know, I think we launched our Left Reckoning 1 on like the first month of December. So that means in 2 years we've missed 4 shows. Not too bad.
You're welcome, patrons.
Yeah. Matt and I, no vacations.
vacations are for losers. We're like Elon Musk. We work a lot of jobs and a lot of stuff falls through the cracks, but we're trying our hardest over here. So.
It's been fun. Thanks everybody so much for making it happen. I'm really hoping people can come and see us in New York. I mean, I think those tickets are selling pretty quick. So it's definitely worth trying to snag them. I think we're talking because it seems like the meet and greet things are selling pretty well. But I want to try to make sure that we might add a couple, but I definitely would try to get them earlier than later because I don't know. I mean, you just if everybody's in there, then it's not really quality time, right? I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's the problem is there's only so much time, and we should honestly think about formats where it's just hanging out. Because that is one of the more fruitful parts of that whole exercise. But I'm excited for the show too, and be interesting to do a show in Manhattan for the first time. We always do our Brooklyn shows.
I know. We were talking about doing Brooklyn, but I was like, you know, the poor people of Manhattan are always forgotten and, you know, don't have a lot of influence and power.
Sort of a cultural backwater when it comes to this sort of thing. Should we start with, let's get a couple phone calls, get warmed up, and then we can get into my maybe friend from Minnesota.
Sounds good.
First call of the evening here. Let's go here.
Hey, everybody. It's Joe Snuffy. All right. So I want to challenge a bit of leftist orthodoxy tonight regarding the U.S. military budget and how it compares to the budgets of other nations, most specifically China. The reason is that I feel that the way that this is usually discussed by most people on the left misses a huge a huge, easily critiqued element of things that I think might be rhetorically more, a bit more successful than just, you know, the general rad lib, we should cut the budget, blah, 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 thing that normally gets said. So anyways, the latest obscene increase in the U.S. military budget was justified as being necessary to prevent China from overtaking us in terms of military capability. And to everybody on the left, that sounds like just an absurd excuse to shovel more money to the military-industrial complex because our budget already dwarfs theirs. Now, it is, but it's a bit more complicated than that. The Radlib critique of our military spending asserts that just because we're spending more, we must be getting more in return for what we're spending. But that actually misses the socialist critique of this issue. China is, in fact, rapidly modernizing their army, rocket force, they've got a specific branch for that, air force, and navy, so quickly that they're only a few years away from achieving regional parity with the portion of the U.S. military that can be devoted into threatening them. Like, we can only send a certain percentage of our assets there. But put another way, China is actually building more military hardware than we are. And what they're building is the equivalent of what we had in the late 90s to early 2000s. And they're doing that while spending roughly a third of what we are on their military. The main reason they can do this is because most of the companies which manufacture military equipment in China are state-owned and thus do not leech profits the way that our military industrial complex does. Well, that and the lower median wages in China, and they've also got some accounting gimmicks as to, they misclassify a lot of warships as search and rescue Coast Guard vessels, but the major thing is it's purchasing power parity. In China, you know, it costs them less to do the same amount of stuff because they don't have capitalist vampires involved. So the thing I want people to add to their talking points against, you know, U.S. military spending is this socialist critique of how the fact that our defense industries are all private corporations, that is what makes us so uncompetitive relative to China, that we need to spend three times as much as they do just to tread water. It's an excellent example of how inefficient capitalism is, and it uses a issue that libs and normies really care about. And personally, I found that explaining the, you know, things this way with regards to this issue is a really good way to plant some seeds. And it's also a good way to get them, it's an angle that will get normies and libs to actually listen to the critique. Whereas if you just say, oh, we just need to cut the budget and blah, blah, like, well, they're so indoctrinated into thinking that we must outcompete China that they just won't listen to anything you say after you say that. So if you give this critique, it's more effective. So anyways, obviously I've simplified this all a lot to keep the voicemail relatively short. Sorry for, you know, the length. But if folks are interested in learning more, they can hit me up in the Discord and I'll give them some references. Anyways, hope everyone's having a good night. All right. Bye.
Profiteers, I mean, in it.
You know, fine criticizing the vampire-like system. But I think it'd be wrong to sit here and think that the reason that our military budget is so big is because that's something that has like universal popular support. I mean, this is something that if like you go and you talk to your average voter on, I think most of them get the kind of criticism as to why like it's insane that we spend so much of our budget solely on the military. Thinking about like, oh, we need to come up with a new argument to convince people to think differently about this, I think sort of misses the problem that it's not necessarily convincing the American public as much as it is like American politicians who have different agendas.
Yeah, I think that's a key point. It does remind me, Harry Truman made a bunch of political bones out of it during World War II, making a show of traveling from factory to factory and seeing where they were profiteering beyond reasonable limits. So, I mean, it's something that has a heritage here, certainly.
And the political thing, I mean, like we talked about this last weekend on our bonus episode. It's also politicians love the military budget because it's a really great way to use a term I don't hear people use as much anymore, Matt. I feel like maybe I'm just not reading the right things. Pork barrel spending. right. I don't hear people saying the word pork anymore like they used to, but maybe that's just
No, that really, you heard that a lot in Obama's first administration, which is ridiculous. That, I mean, our fucking lifetime, man, the politics of our lifetime is dumb as hell.
It's really stupid.
We're magic at the exact same time where we now like can recognize magicking money and putting it into the hands of banks. And we're talking about pork barrel spending to improve fucking infrastructure. Psychotic, like really psychotic stuff we've got going on in America here.
Dude, speaking of that, do you mind if I do like an impromptu gem?
No.
Just give me 1 second to find this because it's been pretty funny. So everyone knows Elon Musk, not doing super well. Before I get into this stuff, I don't know if you have any hot takes on the poll. But, you know, he put out his big poll. Do you want me to step down? He lost. And now they're basically doing a election denial on Twitter right now, which is pretty dark and also a little funny. But I think darker than it is funny.
I got to say, seeing a literal oligarch experiment with democracy and try to see how it can suit him trial and error fashion. And deciding ultimately we need people who can invest in this to be the only ones limited to voting. We can't have actual Vox Populi, Vox Dei, whatever the fuck he was saying. very, very. I mean, it's just, it's humorous. And I mean, it is humor. I understand your desire to, probably responsible. Prompt to take it seriously, but it's funny to me that
I think it's very funny.
Yeah.
But all this is also happening, and you know, going back, if you watch our initial coverage when Musk was first trying to buy Twitter, I was saying, and I wasn't the only one to be saying this, that the deal that he made to finance his buyout of Twitter was horrible, was really bad. particularly how tied it was to Tesla, which is a company that is doing not good. And this is just a good little interaction, and I think gets to some of the Musk mythology here. Because a lot of people don't understand these things, and Musk, I think he gets away with this shit when he talks about space rays and bullshit, right? Yeah. Folks who like don't understand, you know, physics and stuff like that. He does the same thing with the economy. So this is this gentleman, Ross Gerber, you know, certainly a communist, a co-founder, CEO, investment advisor of GK ETF portfolio, et cetera, et cetera. Tesla stock now reflects the value of having no CEO. Great job, Tesla board of directors. Time for a shakeup, Tesla, which is a demand that I'm seeing much more echoed all across like financial press right now. People are pissed because, you know, Tesla, as I've always argued, is a highly overvalued stock, but a lot of people invest in it. You know, one of the more for a time was the highest valued car company in the world, despite the fact that it barely produces any vehicles. So Ross makes this tweet. Musk responds, please tell us your great ideas, Ross, right? Great Elon Musk clapback. And Ross says, as I tweeted earlier, my 3 points, Tesla needs a media and comms team. Tesla needs a succession plan as well as clarify when Elon will be back from Twitter. 3, Tesla needs to communicate about Elon's stock sales and a standstill agreement should be made. And then Musk responds, go back to your securities analysis 101 textbook. In simple terms, as bank savings account interest rates, which are guaranteed, start to approach stock market returns, which are not guaranteed, people will increasingly move their money out of stocks into cash, thus causing stocks to drop. And just put this in like simple speak, he's very like clearly trying to obfuscate his bullshit. But what he's saying here is that low interest rates, and I've been saying this for 10 years, right? Go back to my very first gem on TMBS. Low interest rates create a very weird dynamic in financial capital because low interest rates mean that you're barely getting any kind of return from sort of keeping cash on hand or keeping cash in a bank. And most of the kind of financial products that just sort of follow the general health of the economy don't have a high return on investment either, right? So you're sort of in a race against inflation, right? If inflation is causing the real like value of your dollars that you're putting in a bank account to drop over time, and you're getting very, very low interest rates on keeping it in a bank account or keeping it, you know, in treasury bonds or things like that, you start to look for more and more risky investments. So a lot of the stock market boom that we've seen over the past 10 years has just been money trying to find ways to increase the return on investment that they're not being able to get from more safe traditional investments or from just straight up keeping it in a bank, right? So what Musk is saying is that now that interest rates are rising, it becomes a little bit more attractive for people to go back to more traditional financial investments or even to just keep money in their bank. Right? Brilliant Musk slams idiot communist ETF manager. Well, no, because the fact is that while there is a general trend right now in the stock market, that a negative trend, Tesla is pretty exceptional in this. And Sven Henrik, who again, not a communist, radical, leftist, Marxist, or anything like this, says true for the overall market, but Tesla started broadly disconnecting from the NASDAQ 100 in terms of relative performance this year since the Twitter acquisition was finalized October 27th. I hadn't had this prepped, so there's a better graph here. But if you see the green is Tesla. And the red is the NASDAQ. So you see a very, very clear, here's October, a very, very clear decoupling from Tesla from the trends in the rest of the global economy. So Musk's excuses, again, are bullshit, but they're very, very useful in the way that he tries to, get folks to think that, you know, this, you know, incredible brain genius, Elon Musk, understands things better than me, which must mean that he's right. Musk certainly has a better understanding of the stock market than I think, you know, your average Twitter user, because that's how he makes his money. But that does not mean that he's right and he's not just, you know, lying.
Yeah, he's familiar with it because he manipulates yeah. it all the time. And that's his main concern is like the public relations aspect of it. Steve Ratner, who again, this is the communist who was a former head of the Obama Auto Task Force, Wall Street financier, contributing writer to New York Times op-ed, says Tesla's the 15th worst performing stock on the S&P 500 this year and the third worst performing stock in the 7 weeks since Elon Musk purchased Twitter.
Yeah, and just adding to this point, so you saw the NASDAQ a second ago, but maybe, Matt, we're being cruel. Maybe, you know, it's difficult business for auto manufacturers in the United States, right? Well, no. Here is from Ben Hunt, another very helpful graph here. If you look, the yellow is Ford, the green is GM, and the white is Tesla. If you look at the trend, while Tesla has been going down, which is not good, you've seen an opposite kind of curve for the other auto manufacturers over the past couple of months. So no, this is not something that you can just explain away as like the natural move of, you know, the American financial markets, and rather a very, very direct response to his mismanagement of Tesla. And look, I always have to walk a line here because, you know, I read enough of this stuff that, you know, I can sometimes absorb enough of the conventional wisdom that, you know, I don't want it to dull my radical Marxist blade or anything like that. But no, this is an issue, right? Just using like kind of like Obama style liberal rhetoric here. When you invest into a company, there are certain responsibilities that company has to its shareholders. And what Musk is doing right now is very clearly plummeting the price of a publicly traded company. And he has a responsibility to the shareholders and to the board to be managing his company, which he very clearly is not doing. And because Tesla, again, is a company that doesn't create very many cars. It's a company that trades on the belief in the brain genius of Elon Musk. When he does shit like this, it very much hurts the price of Tesla stock in a way that while there are downward trends in other companies like Ford and GM, there's a manufacturing base, there are plants, there's a lot of capital there that sort of creates a floor. And when investors start to look at Tesla, they see, oh, wait a second, this the kind of basics of this company don't really align very well with its insanely high share price. It's a company that doesn't produce very many cars compared to its competitors. It's a company that has had very serious over the past couple of months and throughout its entire history, questions about the reliability and the safety of those vehicles. And it has an insanely erratic CEO who might not be able to deliver on the big promises that people were buying into Twitter and Tesla in the first place to be able to realize in the future. So Musk's nonsense there, I don't know. I saw that and it just really made me mad because it was a very clear example of Musk just lying through his teeth and trying to use rhetoric that might bamboozle like your average Twitter user who's not sort of following these things. Oh, Musk understands macroeconomics so well. Yeah, you know, destroy this fucking, you know, this idiot communist stock man, Musk. No, that guy had a very decent point that he was making about the way that Musk has been running his company.
You know, it's one thing to like be doing it to snow the average Twitter user, but like, I feel like this stuff has worked on investors up until
now. Oh no, you're so right. You're so
right. And finally, like, it's like, bro, what? And I just got to say, if it took this long, you need to be listening to Left Reckoning and other good folks like ourselves. Cause Jesus Christ, like how did you not see the writing on the wall and exit like this?
Well, Thomas, seeing the writing on the wall, Matt, you got some future telling here that did not turn out the way that was expected.
Yeah, so I saw a recent news appearance by I guess I'll have to share it from here. I thought I uploaded those. just give me 1 second here. Actually, let's play a Dylan from Australia, and then we'll get back to that. I'm not sure what happened to my clips here.
What up, Matthew, David, and the Reckon Nation, where we say Merry Christmas and Giga Maggies. This is Dylan from Australia. Just wanted to let you guys know that in Australia we have put through the gas reservation policy. We've had the peak industry group, Santos, come out and said, this is the road to becoming Venezuela, even though the Conservative government in the UK has done more in terms of taking their profits and redistributing them than we have. Our doyen of our journalism industry has said that the government's forgetting what happened to Kevin Rudd, who's our prime minister, who was involved for trying to introduce carbon tax, and Gough Whitlam, who was involved for attempting to nationalize all of the resources back in the 70s. And we must remember who are the real stakeholders and the traditional owners of Australia, which is the Resources Corporation. So that's good. But, you know, we're just openly saying out loud, you know, you don't want to lose government because you've tried to do the right thing. For those of you who don't know what happened to Gough Whitlam, Matt will like this, but conspiracy theories that the CIA did him in. You know, he was ultimately fired by the Governor General in you know, the dismissal of Gough Whitlam. Very, very complicated. Don't have time to go into it here, except to say that Gough Whitlam didn't have a Merry Christmas. And the Reckon Nation, which is what we should be calling ourselves, we are going to have a Merry Christmas because we know that Christ is King, much like Kanye knows, and there is only one day to celebrate his birth, which is a date that it probably wasn't. Anyways, much love. See you in the new year, and you take care, gentlemen.
It's a beautiful message, Don. Thank you.
You've reminded me of our, you know, of your export to our country, Nick Adams. And I have to ask, Dylan, have you ever been to a Hooters? Do they have Hooters in Australia? Where do the alpha males get some beer and wings there?
David, I have to say, can you, when you try to share a video, are you able to see the Emmer videos, Emmer DeFi and Emmer SBF?
Oh, I'll look really quick. Sorry.
Because I upload them and I can see them when I open up the tab elsewhere. Otherwise, I can just share them from here. But if it's,
I do not see it in the tab. I'm sorry.
All right, no big deal. Well, folks, I was scrolling Twitter and I saw a what is this, Fox Business news story that caught my eye for a number of reasons. One, much like I don't know, you see those James Bond movies and they have Bond sort of basically captured, and you just got to give him the coup de grace, as Elon Musk likes to say. I want to see the final stake put through crypto. I want to see it killed as an industry. I think it is mainly just meant for scamming and that tax avoidance, and I'm not interested in that and facilitating that. So, but we have this entire other counterattack, which is like, no, don't overreact. We just need to regulate this. And that is corruption talking. That is how to formalize this sort of Ponzi scheme into, again, like, and we'll see how this operates through this clip. So first is this clip of a guy named Tom Emmer. Tom Emmer is a Republican congressman from Minnesota. He is the number three ranked Republican in the House. He is the House Majority Whip now, or in the coming session. So big money guy. Let me just play this clip of Tom.
And by the way, it's not about crypto. Remember, this is about centralized finance. DeFi is the point. They're going after decentralized finance. This is not what it's about. Right. It's not about the crypto industry. This is about Sam Bankman-Fried. It's about the regulator, Gary Gensler, and it's about centralized finance, which needs to be brought under our regulatory umbrella. Yeah. And Gary Gensler has done nothing to make that happen.
And I really hope you guys bring in Silicon Valley, which I think plays a major role in this, and a whole bunch of other things that have ripped off the American public. Congressman, again, congratulations.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I hate that shit. Like, bring in Silicon Valley, take them to account by giving them exactly what they want, Charles Payne. Like, Yeah, we'll really take it to Silicon Valley and all these venture capitalists who are calling for this exact thing to happen. Please let please allow us to regulate it. Flashback to last December, 2021, and we get this hearing of Tom Emmer, and he's talking about, he mentions Gensler there, the regulator, and he's had this bone to pick with Gensler because he won't allow Bitcoin to be traded, because Gensler says it's fraudulent. And I'll just say there's a little cameo in the end of this clip that makes it a little bit, delicious, let's just say.
We have seen disapproval letters from the SEC on multiple Bitcoin spot ETF applications. I don't know if you're aware of that. Chair Gensler's justification for not allowing Bitcoin spot ETFs to trade is his belief that Bitcoin spot markets are, quote, vulnerable to fraud and manipulation. Now, it's my understanding that FTX uses surveillance trade technology akin to the technology national securities exchanges use to protect investors and ensure sound spot markets. What does this technology and any other tools FTX uses to protect the spot market from fraud and manipulation look like?
Yeah, so, you know, like other exchanges, we do have these technologies. In addition to the, you know your customer policies that we can identify individuals associated with trades, we have surveillance for unusual trading activity. We have manual inspections of anything that, you know, gets flagged either by the automated surveillance or by manual inspection. And we do this with the trading activity, with the deposits, the withdrawals, and everything else.
Sounds like you're doing a lot to make sure there is no fraud.
He was doing
or
a
other
lot.
Manipulation. thank you, Mr. Bankman-Fried.
Thank you.
Again, for helping us understand the extensive guardrails a cryptocurrency exchange like FTX has in place to ensure sound crypto spot markets for investors.
Just to for anybody who doesn't know, Sam Bankman-Fried is the person recently arrested famously for a bunch of fraud. And I love how FTF thanks him back. Like, thank you, Mr. Bankman-Fried, for showing us all the just the great little safeguards you have to make sure people can do this safely.
Then, like, look, you're not going to hear too many shout outs from me on the federal government. I think they should have been much more hawkish on this from the beginning. But the whole reason that you know that there was skepticism from the government on this is not because they're worried about these people making money or being revolutionaries and opening up finance to the general public, right? It's because from the outside it looked very, very much not only like a house of cards, but something that could be very easily manipulated by people at the top of these systems, which would be illegal in any other circumstance. And the only reason these things were allowed to float for so long is because there's a lot of confusion about how they worked, I think, in general by the general public, but more importantly by like the regulators. And when you look at what Bankman, what happened to FTX, I mean, it's a pretty typical scheme of lying to investors and taking their money. I mean, it's a Ponzi scheme in like in its most basic sense, that you're taking folks' money in order to shore up other aspects of your operations so that you have the appearance of sound money, so money keeps on coming in, so that you can maintain, the money to yourself, but the general confidence in that system. And it's fraud. It's very clear. Yeah. I think everyone understands that it's fraud. And it's just funny to talk out of both sides of your mouth like that fellow did.
And to continue to push it too, yeah. Like to continue to push Bitcoin. And I want to say, like, shame on Tom Emmer. Shame on Kirsten Gillibrand. Shame on every member of the United States government who is playing footsie with this shit. Loomis, too. Because all that is fodder for this fucking marketing. That all you're doing is separating people from their money who wouldn't otherwise have been, but for, oh, look, this senator is actually in on it. This congressperson is in on it. All those people, like, it's disgusting to me. And, like, I looked into Emmer's background a little bit. He says he's done a lot of these crypto podcasts. He says he got into it because one of his staff members gave him a book, and that very might well well be true. Whether he's a true believer or if he's just been like bought off by a lot of the crypto FTX cash, which is sloshing around and apparently in dark money, so we're not actually going to know where all of it went. It's abhorrent to use the government to promote shit like that. And it's unacceptable. And I'll just a little bit more background on Emmer. So one good thing in 2014, around 2013, 14, he was maybe 14, working on dropping the embargo to Cuba, which we applaud. His reasons, you know, are the sort of American exceptionalist pro-trade reasons, but we'll take it. But he's also a standard sort of MAGA-ish, Tea Party-ish Republican. He, among other things, working backwards, he's the guy who sort of like both sides and kind of had some really big concerns about did Trump maybe win the election and it was stolen. Wasn't very courageous about that. Also he thinks on abortion, moment of fertilization kind of guy. Now he ran for office a while ago, and this is a sort of kicker that I want to share with you. He ran for office and got in trouble because this Minnesota Public Radio article came out about what he wanted to do with regards to employee tips. So Emmer, count employees' tips towards minimum wages, he said. Republican gubernatorial candidate Tom Emmer said the state could gain jobs if employers could pay a lower hourly wage to employees who earn a lot of money from tips. Stopped by the Eagle Scout Grill in St. Paul Monday morning, saying government needs to listen to business about reducing regulatory burdens and adding jobs. With the tips that they get to take home, they are some people earning over $100,000 a year, more than the very people providing the jobs and investing not only their life savings, but their family's futures, Emmer said. If this is happening, I mean...
Well, you know...
Go ahead.
This kind of rhetoric like infuriates me as somebody who spent a long time in this industry. One, because even within like the restaurant industry or just general like tipped industry, there's a tiered system. There are nice places where you can make a lot of money, and then there's the vast majority of places where you're eking it out, right? And even at the nice places, I think $100,000 in Minnesota might be sort of pushing it. I mean, we're talking like maybe in a DC or a Manhattan at like a really, really, really nice place.
Right.
You could maybe approach something like that.
But which they, good, you know, because yeah. By the way, expensive cities, right? Like we should have people who serve food living in, I mean, a similar, I mean, can we say that like type of life as the people that they're constantly waiting on?
But again, we're talking about like the top 1 to 5% of wage earners in that industry, right? In that area, right? So it's a bullshit argument from the in the first place. And like, I remember this in DC when they passed the minimum wage for tip workers law there that ended up getting overturned by the city council despite having massive popular support. The way that like Jose Andreas, who everyone loves, really nasty business owner. He does nice charity work when a hurricane hits and stuff. Good. But he also uses that as a shield so that he can try to fight to underpay his employees back in DC. You know, they'll go and they'll talk to somebody at like a Le Diplomat. If you don't know, you know, I'm just using names of places. Right. You don't have to know them, but like, you know, where people do make a lot of money, and they might talk to like a bartender there. Who's like, oh, well, I already make enough money. I'm not worried about this. And I'm worried that this is going to mean I get less in tips or et cetera, et cetera. When you look at like the actual, what tip wage earners make in cities like that, they're barely getting over the poverty line for the most part. Because for the most part, people are working in places where if they get a tip, the overall amount on the check is low, right? And that's how they're going to get money, right? Or they work in restaurants and places where the clientele are the types that don't tip, or they tip $1 regardless of like how much they ordered. And I don't know, I just find these arguments to be really nefarious. Because they create a situation where you're like, oh yeah, I bet somebody is making, or I've made a tip before that was like $50. That seems like a lot of money. And then you sort of extrapolate that across the entire industry, which is suffering from this. Right. And you utilize like the people at the highest end of the wage spectrum to sort of make a point that like, oh yeah, tip workers are doing wonderful in this country, which is absolute bullshit.
No, well, if I was a tipped worker, I would just have one of the, I would just wait on one of those people who give you the $15,000 tips because they're
feeling smart.
Like Christmas yeah. season.
This is a post game really quick.
Yeah,
I know our friends out here who've spent time waiting tables have experienced this, but man, oh boy, I still get mad thinking about this. A bunch of there's this evangelical, and I don't know if it was related to a particular church or something like that. But they would not tip. But what they would do would be really nasty is they would put in a fake $100 bill, right? Into their check at the end of the thing. So like, oh, wow, I got a big tip from these people. That's like your first reaction. And you look closer, you realize it's funny money. And then on it is some clip from the Bible about like not coveting wealth, which is like the nastiest thing in the world. I'm not going to pay you for the job that you just did for me. And I'm also going to like leave you a note lecturing you about coveting wealth, which is.
Yeah, that's you, motherfucker. You're the one coveting it. Cough it up. Jesus yeah, Christ. It
happened to me more than once, unfortunately. Well,
look, don't react too negatively to Tom Emmer. He did something to try to make it up for everybody who's gone through and actually worked one of these jobs. And this is it. And, you know, if this isn't a good enough apology, then, you know, we have to talk about paths to redemption in this country.
We're talking about making sure everyone can be successful. We want servers to be successful. We want the wonderful owners of our restaurants here in Minnesota. I don't know how many people know we lost 300 of them last year. We want them to be successful. We want people like Tom and Jackie Emmer, normal Minnesotans, to be able to go on a date night once in a while, be able to afford it. I want everybody to win. So, you know, I got a little criticism, whether it's fair or unfair. It doesn't matter. It's a great issue to talk about because we all want the same things. We want people to be successful. So what I've done tonight is I've come to Old Mexico here in Roseville, and we're going to wait on a few tables. We're going to walk a mile in their shoes. So let's see how it goes. Okay, there you go. We got the little glovies out. Now, watch this. Oh.
Man of the people.
He's also not doing it. You know, he's being trained like someone else is.
Yes, he's absolutely hurting their efficiency for the evening.
Not only is he hurting their efficiency, he's not having to deal with it. Like someone else is like managing all this stuff and just saying like, if you wait tables, you know the like. People sometimes have this, I think, from outside, like have this amount. It's like, look, the hard part of the job is not bringing a drink to a table or even asking people what they want. It's you got 10 tables and you got to get all of these things out in like in a certain way, right? And he has someone managing and doing that labor for him. The only thing he's doing is like, yeah, man, I'm glad that you walked a mile in you know these folks' shoes. You did it on a leash, right? You can't do that. Like
you simulated it. You might as well have been playing Restaurant Simulator, just at an actual restaurant.
Honestly, that's probably more stressful.
Right, yeah, you actually have those sort of like prioritizing different things problems, as opposed to this is just walking through one simple technique of balance the drinks on a tray, say hi to people that are waiting for their food.
I mean, I've scraped up by those old asbestos tiles on demolition projects in stores over at Southtown Mall. You know what? Labor is labor. It's what you put in it is what you're going to get out of it. And today was a great example. Elizabeth, who I met, who was helping me, let me shadow her, was very patient. Some guy on the radio today was saying how it's unskilled labor. I'll tell you what, I dare him to try and carry a tray with 25 pounds of hot steaming dishes on top of it, be able to know which ones they're going to, be able to run back and pick up the next table and be smiling and happy for the third one. You know, this is not an easy job. This is hard work. And the servers get exactly what they put into it. The good ones get rewarded very well. It's just a good reminder. It's not as if we didn't know that. It's just a good reminder. Is it good to walk a mile in someone else's shoes? There's a couple things that I'd say right now. One, you've got employers that have, they would like to comp meals for their employees all over town. And yet we've got some insane tax requirement where these guys are supposed to track every meal that they provide for an employee. That should be, again, something that's negotiated between the employee and their employer, not between the employee, the employer, and the government, all right? That needs to go away. The other one that I've always thought was awful, even from my days as a busboy at the Camelot restaurant, they should not have to report their tips. Tips should not be taxed. That's my belief. Again, let's get government.
Again, doesn't sort of affirmatively talk about the
I'm
wages.
Glad that that lesson really helped him out later. he was saying there, the waiters got it too good. Yeah, I mean, yeah. A pretty classic GOP guy.
Right? Yeah, I like the thing of like, because this is in response to that. This is like people getting pissed at him. And then he's like, he still has to put in the thing of like, and some get really well paid. He still put his dig at like, there's all these six figure ones. And we know that. Like, he can't, oh man.
And I don't know what he was talking about with Minnesota. So I don't want to talk too, you know, whatever. I'm just saying, I don't know what's going on. But it seems like he's talking about, they need to report meals to the government. I mean, I can only assume he's talking about enforcing that if you work 8 hours, you should get a meal or at least a meal time break on your shift.
I interpret it. That's one. I interpret it as bosses should be able to give free food to the employees and have that not sort of counted in any sort of like, inventory or
I mean I guess I you know not to sound like a closet Republican if the trouble there is that restaurant owners are getting in trouble for being generous with their employees that I'm with them but I have a feeling that he's probably mad that
he's just trying to make stuff up because he doesn't want to get back to the point of like oh yeah we should like make sure there's a minimum wage here that is above the two whatever the fucking federal one is. And he's like, he's trying to say all these other things that a libertarian that would actually help the workers, opposed to that. So he's just grasping.
Yeah, totally.
Tom Emmer, man. Anything else I need to say about him? Oh yeah. He tried to, do a sovereign citizen thing in the Constitution in 2010. So just a really like a dumb guy. Yeah,
oh, totally.
Third most powerful Republican in the Congress.
Well, that's good. I think we're in good hands. What should we do? Talking about smart boys, should we do these this TPUSA thing before we do questions and calls? So we'll play this whole bit here for folks. This is from our friend Lance at the Serfs, who I don't think we need to direct people to anymore. He's been doing very well.
Yeah.
He's been an incredible force on the left media scene for the past few years. But if you don't know, you should definitely check out the Serfs TV. This is something that he found from a recent TPUSA special. So in a TPUSA special, Tim Pool sitting alongside James Lindsay, Charlie Kirk, and Steve Bannon go on a rant about how corporations use wokeness as a shield. Tim Pool goes on to tell a story about how the entire Occupy movement was completely segregated based on race.
Both seeing the symptoms of this sugar high money cycle of fewer and fewer people getting really rich. Bernie came at it from an outright Marxist view. Trump came at it from a populist nationalist view. And Bernie Sanders should have really been the nominee in 2016, but Hillary Clinton rigged the game. Trump became the nominee and obviously won in a shocking fashion. What we are now living through 14 years later is the economic catastrophe of Timothy Geithner and Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson. But here's the thing, and this is why James Lindsay's work is so incredible. These corporations think they are immune to criticism and revolution because they have wokeness as a shield. They have an iron dome. They think they are protected from...
Wait, I'm sorry.
An iron dome?
This might just be me, but I just like the Steve Bannon nodding in the background. Ready?
As a shield. They have an iron dome.
Yes.
They think they are protected from criticism. Because they can say men can become pregnant, white people are evil. Wokeism is the only thing they have left protecting them from hundreds of millions of people realizing that they're robber barons against the civilization.
The first time I encountered the wokeness, whatever, Occupy Wall Street. Initially, you know, I'm down there, And I'm sure Luke has similar experiences. There's a lot of people who are just economic populists. They say, I don't know, the two parties are bad, whatever. But then all of a sudden, these organizers started gaining more and more traction who believed in the progressive stack and white men are evil. There's a good comic that embodies this. And it's a rich guy in a big chair with protesters outside saying, we are the 99%. And he's on the phone saying, introduce them to identity politics. All of a sudden, wokeness started taking over. And then from there, I started seeing it get bigger and bigger. And you know what? For me, I didn't think much of it other than these people are weirdos, despite the fact that I remember one night there was a young black guy who was watching all of this happen. And I overheard him say, y'all are crazy. You're segregating people by race. I don't have anything to do with this. Occupy actually created their organizational structure based around your race. They put all the black people in one group, all the Latinos, all the Asians. Oh, yeah, I
wonder why it fell apart.
No wonder, right? Yeah.
So we got that. Let's just let him close it out before Matt.
Just say, like, yeah. Nobody knows about Tim Pool if it's not for Occupy. It's a little bit much, I think, to be. Well, whatever. Let's play the second part.
The people on the right immediately assumed that it was like a leftist, liberal, or something wrong.
Oh, yeah, this is good.
And so what happens? That first weekend is big. Second weekend is bigger. But people who have jobs, people who are conservative and libertarian, were like, I've got to leave and I've got to go home. And the only people who were able to stick around were Marxists, trust fund kids, well off. And so the left ended up taking. I think.
Okay. So. Let's go all the way to the back, and then maybe we can talk about Occupy if that makes sense to Matt. So the first claim is that the corporations use wokeness as a shield to protect themselves from genuine and correct criticisms of the unequal society that we're living in, the abuse that they do to the American society. And I think there's no doubt about it that there's a PR strategy from companies to try to present themselves as like nice and they get it. They're hip with the times. They're not, crusty old men sitting, you know, that the meme of the first Bush and folks drinking champagne in a private room, members of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Right there, you know. Okay, yeah, no doubt. I think that it's fair to say there's a media strategy from these companies to present themselves in a certain way. But there's another aspect to this is that they use it as a shield. It's their iron dome. Wait, let me just get this to the end really quick. That it's an iron dome and it protects them from criticism. Well, criticism's from who, right? Because what James Lindsay would say, what our boy Kirk would say, and Poole too, I'm assuming, is that the left is so woke and crazy that they get distracted by the rainbow flag on a Coca-Cola can or something like that, right? And show me where that actually happens. Show me the left that goes from, oh, well, I hated this corporation, but I saw that they did an ad where they included a trans person. So now I actually think they're just swell, right? That's not something that's happening. They operate from such a high level of cynicism that they're arguing that Occupy, right? And like, I really actually want to address separately the Occupy stuff, because I actually think there are some things that are worth noting about what Poole was saying. But that, like, Occupy was like actually, you know, this genuine and even sympathetic, right? It sounds like they're being a little sympathetic to Occupy if I'm feeling it correctly. But they got distracted by the woke stuff, and now they're so distracted by it they can't be against corporations
anymore. Yeah. Classic Lord of the Flies, but with wokeness.
Look, and it's just like, I think almost everybody can see through the nonsense for the most part. People who are making criticisms of capitalist corporations for doing capitalist things aren't getting distracted by woke stuff. There is a general population who, like, they spend all their time doing culture war stuff. They don't really work through these things, because they never really had a strong economic critique of companies in the first place. They just wanted to be on the good side, bad side kind of the argument. So, like, I'm not saying that the woke marketing or all that kind of stuff doesn't have some kind of effect. I'm not saying that it doesn't play a role. But if the target here is that it's like depoliticizing like a workers movement, or to use their incredibly vague term, economic populist movement, I think it's like fairly nonsensical.
Yes. I mean, it's completely stupid. The idea that that's all that came from Occupy, and I wasn't there. I was living in North Dakota at the time. Bet there was some dumb stuff going around there. But the idea that that's the legacy from Occupy and not like, I mean, just name one, like all like the debt sort of working groups that all these different people were working on that led to activism around like, say, student loan debt for something like that. That makes that like a, like things emerge from that, including the exact same thing Tim's talking about, which is like, okay, like there may be people emphasizing the progressive stack. I'll be honest. I've been in this progressive media space for almost a decade now. I've barely heard of the progressive stack. Like it's not like a sort of hegemonic idea here. It's like, I mean, there's a whole entire left, and I know that Tim Pool is aware of this because Candace Owens had Cornel West on, like a conversation with Cornel West, right? Like there's an entire left about that all these folks are sort of devoted to obscuring or smearing on a day-to-day basis for those people in those executive, that 1% that doesn't want this energy to get moved in an anti-capitalist way, because Tim Pool and all these people are pro-capitalist.
So I want to like hold off on the Occupy stuff just for 1 second to like make another point about the wokeness of the corporations, because it goes back, because like for Kirk, for Lindsay, for Tim Pool, you know, they note something that I think is genuinely correct, right? That like a lot of American corporations want to present themselves in a certain light. But they overstate it because they don't want to deal with the fact, because their criticisms of these corporations is not that they're capitalist corporations. It's that they're big, and I guess some big corporations are okay as long as they don't have gay families in their commercials or something like that, right? It's like it's a nonsensical criticism. The reason that like these companies don't get into trouble, right? The reason that Amazon doesn't get into trouble is not because Amazon like has a has a press statement where they recognize people of all different genders. The reason that Amazon doesn't get in trouble is because they have incredible amounts of money and influence, and politicians across the country are very interested in getting access to that money and influence, and they don't want to end up on the other side of it. Look no further than like what happened where like all of these cities were tripping over themselves to give one of the world's wealthiest men, access
intelligence.
To city, intelligence access to their city. It's not because he's fucking doing woke shit. It's because they want the influence and the power and the money that comes with being aligned with an Amazon, right? Which again is not something that came about from like whatever cultural shifts that we've seen over the past 10, 15 years. That's old school capitalism, right? Industrialist, capitalist, people with money trying to influence influence politicians, and politicians being very, very happy to accept the bribes and all the shit that comes with it, right? Because their criticism is never about capitalism. It's never about an unequal society. It's solely just that social mores are becoming more inclusive. And those are obviously going to be reflected in corporate marketing and corporate advertising. So they're seeing a shift, and they're trying to blame the consolidation and the power and the influence that corporations have on quote unquote wokeness, when no, man, it's about fucking money. Like it always has been.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what more there is to say.
Well, I want to say some stuff on the Occupy thing. Cause I was on Occupy. I was there, in DC. Like Occupy started my first year of college. So I was, I was there in DC. Actually, I was hanging out with them recently. I saw Mike Prisoner, speak at the first, during that first weekend of Occupy, which is, I don't know, it was fun for me to be able to hang out with them later. But, That's besides the point. What Poole's saying, like, there's some truth to what he's saying, not in the nonsensical way, but like in facts on the ground, right? Mm-hmm. One, there actually were libertarians there. They were weird. Right. They were on the outskirts, but they were there. And
I remember the Ron Paul people in my area were supportive of
the Ron Paul people were there, and there was actually no. I saw it happen. The kind of like hyper progressive nonsensical thing of like trying to create segregation within the community. I saw that happen. That's bad. But yeah. Again, that happened because Occupy had no structure. So apart from what Tim Pool saying is like the organizational structure of Occupy was doing this. No, it wasn't. The point was that there was no organizational structure. So anything fucking goes. So one day some people decide we're going to do this kind of more wacky, silly organizational strategy of trying to separate people via race. They got to do that because there was nobody to say no. And a lot of people sort of went along with it because people were like, okay, this is a new thing to me. I'm happy to see where this goes. And obviously now you see that's not a great way to build solidarity. It's certainly not a way to build a long-lasting movement. So that kind of shit happened. But again, it happened because there was no structure or organization to Occupy. The criticisms of Occupy are, from my perspective, are – that it actually got people motivated and mobilized, but it had no vehicle to do anything with it. So it wasn't that the conservatives all had to go to work. Everybody had to go to work. Like what the, right. Like the idea that the only people who stopped showing up were the conservatives because the conservatives had to go to work, or even the idea that frankly, a significant portion there were people who are quote unquote like conservatives is nonsensical. There were some libertarian people because a lot of libertarians were part of the anti-war movement and a lot of Occupy came out of the anti-war movement. So people were swimming in the same circles. And you saw after that was probably the last big mobilization where you saw those figures and anti-lefty, anti-war people sort of together on the same stage. That ended after that because the criticism of capitalism was too much for the libertarians. It wasn't because they had to go to work.
Right.
It's because they didn't like this kind of this kind of criticism about the engine of our economy that was a part of was a big part of Occupy.
Yeah, the taking your eye off the ball to get fixated on cultural shit, that's the critique of the right section of that.
So anyway, I mean, no news to our audience, but, you know, liars and grifters over there. I would like to see if we could find more of what Lindsay was saying. But
also, like, the reason corporations, say, like, make nods towards anti-racism is because there's a growing awareness of this country's legacy of racism. Yeah. And they want to maintain some level of popular sort of credibility. That's and along because that's tied closely to their profits. That's like, and they should be applauded for that as we expropriate them.
Yeah. Well, I think Matt and I have said enough. Maybe it's time for the portion of the show where we get to hear from the audience.
Let's do it.
Do you want to start with calls or I?
We have one call left and then we can do our Discords.
How is it going, Left Reckoning? I assume everyone is bracing for the big cold front. Those of us who have cattle are a little concerned. I wanted to take this time, you know, to say goodbye to David. As you know, every time it dips below 40 degrees in Texas, I just assume the worst, that half the state's going to perish. So if you make it, great. If not, we've enjoyed, you know, all of your insight. It has been good. I know Matt will survive. He's a good prairie lad. So, you know, he can handle, you know, negative 40 degree weather with 40 mile an hour winds. That's just time. How we roll. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you survive and make it to the live show and stuff next month, I hear that old Joe Snuffy will be there as well. So maybe we can finally get this 2v2 basketball game going and, you know, really put your guys' skills to the test. Looking forward to that. But on a serious note, with the oil spill, it looks like they are going to be potentially getting the pipeline going again without having to publicly disclose what exactly caused it to pop, but Yeah, you would really think they'd want to figure that part out first, but apparently they don't have to disclose that. It might have something to do with, you know, running it over capacity for 5 years, but who is to say? We literally don't know. So, yeah, that's reassuring. I wonder how many other lines are being run at excess capacity due to some leftover Trump regulations. But, yeah, we should all sleep well at night. But, you know, what could possibly go wrong inciting a bunch of fanatics, especially in eastern Kansas? That's never really caused any problems for the establishment before. Hint, hint, John Brown. All right. Well, I will talk to you guys later. And if I don't, for some reason, get into the phone lines at MR, may you have a very happy holidays. Bye.
Oh.
Thank you, Kowalski. It reminds me of, I don't know if this is still the case, but there's a book on the Koch brothers called Sons of Wichita that starts with a description of a lawsuit that they lost where one of their gas pipelines was leaking. Leaked a whole bunch of gas into this area, and somebody's just driving their car down a highway, and the combustion engine entered the tank of gas, or entered the cloud of gas, and kaboom, a massive explosion.
So, oh, man.
But they got, you know, a lot of gas to market, so, you know.
There you go. That's all you need.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm hoping that the grid's going to be okay. It's going to be cold, but I don't know if this will be sustained long enough to be super warm. But I am worried. I'm a huge baby. I need to be. Me and my fiance have been fighting over a thermostat lately. I need.
Do you like it warm, or and she likes it cold?
Yeah, I need it. I need it very warm.
See, I need it cold, and yeah, it's a problem.
Like how cold? Like what's the room?
I like it chilly. I like it chilly to the point where I have a blanket that I cover up with, but I like it to be like bracingly cool.
No,
in the room.
I need like 70. Like that's like my bottom of comfort. I don't want to wear a sweater inside the house.
I don't mind. See, I like it, especially when I can, when I convert it to like, oh, I'm saving money on heat. but yeah.
Since this is the last show before Christmas, you know, those like the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the like with the puppets and shit.
Right.
I think it's the third one of them, but they do one where they go to the South. And it's a heat miser versus snow miser. You haven't seen this?
No.
This is like from the 60s, man. I'm not like coming up with
this. I don't remember the one where they went to the South.
There's the heat miser, the snow miser, right? You know snow miser. I'm pulling this up.
I remember the Island of Misfit Toys. I don't remember them going to
that one South sucks. Carolina. That's my least. That's the worst one. I'm pulling it up right now just like to jog your memory. You ain't seen this guy before? Snow miser, heat miser?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I remember those guys.
Yeah.
They're from the South?
No, they're not from the South, but in the thing, they're going to this, they go to Southtown. And they do a green Christmas song, which, you know, because all the Christmas stuff is about snow. And they're like, you know, they needed to show some love for the rest of the country that doesn't ever get a white Christmas. Or if it does, it's probably a very, very bad thing.
See, I don't even know if we got that because we always got a white Christmas. So they probably didn't even bother giving us the feel good about your not white Christmas special.
It's going to snow right down in Dixie. Duh, 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 duh. Yeah, anyway.
I heard Australia, maybe Dylan can confirm this next.
Oh yeah, they have a hot one.
But they have yeah, a hot Christmas, and I heard the carols like mention that, like it's warm down here. Again, it's Christmas.
See, good. I think we need a break from the yoke of the British and be able to celebrate Christmas in our own way.
Yeah.
All right, we only have a couple Discords, so let's go through them. Joe Snuffy says, my favorite part of that Josh Hawley clip, holy crap, he's creepy as hell, is how he meant to say, tell her that she's the one. But he accidentally said, tell her she's a one, which I read as a meaning that he believes the guys in the audience are only capable of attracting women who are 1 out of 10. Very weird self.
That's not very nice, but that's funny.
Cromlet Josh says, hey guys, this might be a bit more of a think tank question or one for Danny and or for when Danny or Gene are on the show, but there's been a scandal this week involving European Parliament MEPs potentially taking bribes from the Qatari lobby and possibly the Moroccan lobby too. I think this is often a tricky issue. I think this is also often a tricky issue when we discuss foreign policy on the left, which is how important are lobbies? I know Chomsky disagrees with Mersheimer's arguments about the Israel lobby, saying that the U.S. didn't need an Israel lobby or an Indonesia lobby to back right-wing governments. I agree, but I also think Sukarno was around now. You'd probably never hear the end of the Indonesia lobby.
You know, I mean, I remember that debate about the Mersheimer book on the Israel lobby, and I think when it comes to like these sorts of democracies, they are impactful. Like the politicians are, they have a strong gravity towards politicians, and I think that does matter.
There's multiple aspects to a lobby, right? There's the straight up money. Right. And there's this thing like, I don't want to have to go up against a campaign that's going to be heavily funded by people of a specific policy lobby. So I'm going to vote that way to sort of save my own skin.
Mm.
There's the other side of it, which is like the nuts and bolts organizing thing where you make something enough of a headache for a politician, and they will be more likely to vote one way than the other because they're only hearing one thing. Not that they haven't considered either, you know, both sides of it, but, oh, I'm only hearing about one, you know, me voting one side of this. So, you know, to avoid getting in trouble, I'll go that way. And then, what was the third one? And then there is like the other side of it, which is that Congress people a lot of times do not know what the fuck they're getting into. So this is something that I think is more important for not marginal in the sense of like the importance of what's happening, you know, globally, but things that like aren't hot topics in the U.S. They just get handed like a brief sheet on something by either like an industry lobbyist or like a lobbyist for, you know, a certain kind of international position, and they just run with it. And you'd be surprised how effective that can be in U.S. politics, but it is. So I think that I hear Chomsky's point, and I think that sometimes the lobby gets overstated versus mm-hmm. some of the structural reasons for like the United States is like the reason that the United States, you know, supported Israel was for it to be like a bulwark against what was seen as like Soviet incursions in the Middle East. You know, so like there's a reason that there was that support from the get-go. And then the lobbies play a role of sort of hounding people on the edges to sort of fall in line. So I think that sometimes you can overstate and sitting here thinking like, well, if the Israel lobby went away tomorrow, you know, we'd be living in a different society. It's the same thing with like money and politics in general.
I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Oh, if we didn't have, you know, corporate donations, then we wouldn't have to deal with these. And it's like, no, like politicians would still be answering the phone for the capitalist class. It doesn't mean that they don't peddle influence and utilize the tools at their disposal. So, you know, it's a little bit of like, you know, both and, you know, to that question.
And I will say, I do think Citizens United and structural changes like that do make lobbies more important materially.
Joe Snuffy also adds, too bad Xander and Summer aren't on the chat because I'd love to have asked them if they could explain what's going on with the stepmom thing. It has to be, it seems to have taken over, but how did that become a new baseline for plot lines? We'll just have to let that, you know.
I mean, they do Twitch streaming, so.
Yeah, there you go. And Dylan, I'm not going to curse on the stream. He said something about the Aggies, but he did say Merry Christmas, which I will say to the rest of y'all. Merry Christmas to everybody. Happy holidays as well. And, man, it's been a fun show. Oh, we got one last sneaky one. Beating the buzzer from our friend Dylan, who says, What do y'all make of the JFK document showing the FBI was aware of Oswald telling the Russian embassy he wanted to assassinate? See, Dylan, you can't do this. Like, I was like, get a nice wrap up. I'll ask you though, Matt, because you probably haven't answered this. What do you make of the JFK document showing the FBI was aware of Oswald telling the Russian embassy he wanted to assassinate Kennedy, and then J. Edgar Hoover ignored it out of spite?
I have not seen that specifically, but I know there was a lot of. I mean, I have to look into that, Dylan. Mm-hmm. Are you making that up? I know that the FBI is hiding a lot of stuff about the mafia. I haven't seen specifically, like, I mean, there's a lot of stuff submerged about Oswald taking a trip to Russia as a former Marine, and that just being treated as if it was like nothing to be nothing the United States intelligence services should be concerned about, and that was just part of the cover up that the CIA and the FBI did, saying we didn't know anything about this guy, barely heard of him. Well, no, you were actually tracked him as you would any member of the military going to Russia at this point in time. But no, I mean, no, I'm not really super familiar with that specifically.
And last one of the night, Zane says, thoughts on the University of Austin. I heard their sociology graduate program is really good. You know, I haven't heard much about the U of Austin since they've had a lot of high profile people step down from their board, though. I do worry about what the next chapter, knowing Barry Weiss's, cozying up to Musk, might mean for the future. All I will say is, could these people please just leave my fucking hometown alone for a minute? I really can't. Like, there's enough. We're fighting for like affordable housing and all this shit. I can't deal with all of these right wingers' fascination with this town. But everyone, Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. I hope you have a good one. We'll be back this Sunday with our bonus episode. We'll be back next Tuesday for the main show. I'll be here on Thursday with the Griscom stream. Come see us in New York City on January 22nd. And yeah, folks, everyone take care and see you soon.
Peace.